Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And you join us for an hour of chat about Land Rovers and everything to do with owning them. So, Steve, the big news is Land Rover have won its class in the Dakar Rally.
Yeah, do you know what? I just saw that yesterday, actually. That's fantastic news.
It's a serious achievement for their sort of debut, really, in the especially with the latest, obviously the new Defender, the stock class. Yeah, top three finishes in the stock class. Absolutely amazing news.
Now, that really is good. It just proves that, Land Rover have built a decent thing. Although, you know, arguably it's not a factory car, is it? It's completely kind of...
Well, they're obviously modified for Dakar, but they're part of the stipulations of the stock class is that the body has to be standard.
Okay.
It has to use standard engine, things like that. So,
enough then. Yeah.
You can obviously, you fit roll cage, it's got coilover suspension on it, bigger fuel tank, stuff like that. But the actual main backbone of it, although obviously highly ProDrive, I believe, had the job of preparing the Defenders, the D7XR, to call it its actual name for Dakar, and evidently it's worked. They're basically based on the Defender Octa, which is, as we know, quite a thing in itself. But the Dakar versions obviously has to put up with a lot more than it would do on UK roads or anywhere else. It's had a punishing old time, but it has prevailed.
QV replicas now, what do you reckon?
Well, there's talk, it's a bit of a rumour that Land Rover might do an even more hardcore road-going version than the Octa, based on the Dakar version. So whether that will be sort of like a bowler bulldog type thing, but in the latest shape, we will have to wait and see.
Can you imagine you'll be invited to purchase the significant price as well?
Could well be. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be, if they do it, it will be a seriously limited thing. But yeah, 8,000 kilometres of terrain in Saudi Arabia, 8,000 kilometres, 13 stages.
Yeah.
Absolutely, like, amazing, really. I wonder if, because there was only Land Rover or JLR and Toyota in the stock class this year, but I wonder if that will really rile up other manufacturers to enter sort of in future events. I think it would be brilliant to grow that class because it's really, I think it's probably, aside from possibly classic, which we'll get onto in a minute, really, really exciting class for Dakar and off-road racing in general, I would say.
It certainly puts it on the map, doesn't it? Again, it reminds people that there is motorsport out there to be had.
Absolutely.
With Land Rovers, even from a basic level, you know, an entry level.
I suppose it's always been really relevant, hasn't it? The even going back to like touring cars and stuff like that, you know, win on Sunday and people go and buy on Monday. It really does enforce the latest crop of vehicles from JLR are that capable. I know it's been really good as well. I'll tell you what it has done is it's opened up a lot of positivity in owners groups. I've been looking at on social media of people who've got Defenders, and they've said they've obviously been really encouraged and really, you know, riled up and, you know, in a positive way by this win, because it just goes to show that the lineage is still strong. Do you know what I mean?
You're backing it, aren't you, from the word go? You want it to win.
People are really proud to own them, and that's really, really good. I don't know, it's really quite an uplifting thing to happen, and fair play to JLR and ProDrive, because it's no, and of course all the drivers as well, drivers and co-drivers who have put up with that serious pasting that Saudi Arabia desert will give you. I can't imagine how hard it must be, the lack of sleep and the preparation and the navigation and, you know, just the pure sort of staying power you must have to be successful in a rally like this.
So imagine like the adrenaline takes you through most of the way, doesn't it? And then you train your fitness levels beforehand.
Yeah.
And the adrenaline takes you through. I should imagine when it's over, you would just collapse in a big heap on the floor.
I bet. The concentration it must take to stay focused and know exactly what you're doing all the time, because there's small lapse in concentration at you know, at those speeds in that kind of terrain, it's going to be end very, very badly. So we must, of course, give a massive congratulations to Helen Tate Wright and Marcella Kirk, who we've had on the podcast fairly recently. They entered in the Dakar Classic in their 110 Purdy TD5 powered 110, and they completed it. I've been in the WhatsApp group with them, and seeing the sort of conditions and what they've had to put up with through the event is really eye opening. And what an incredible thing to achieve! Even as I say, getting through the rally mentally and physically must be so punishing. So well done, ladies. I hope you're recuperating now, and we'll catch up soon. We'll have to get you back on the podcast, I think.
Yeah, I definitely think that needs to be in the podcast again, doesn't it? And possibly in the pages of LRM and Land Rover Life.
Yes, absolutely. The classic class, I believe, was won, in fact, by a Series 3 109, which is pretty cool. I haven't got too many details on that, but by the sounds of it, Land Rover put in a sterling effort all round, really.
Yeah, that's
what is, a huge deal, really, for off-road racing and rallies, and just an overall, it's just really good. It's positive.
I feel good. Yeah.
Top work, everyone. nice work. Really, really cool. Really, really good to see. But things haven't been quite as positive on my driveway as you might have seen on Instagram, Steve.
I may have seen that yesterday. Or was it the day before? I can't remember. But yeah.
So
your TDI conversion isn't going quite to plan, or it did go to plan and then it didn't.
The plan went perfectly. It is converted to a TDI. Unfortunately, the TDI engine I bought from what I assumed was a reputable breaker turned out to not be quite as good as I was promised. I've been test driving it, and when I got back from the first test drive, I noticed that the idle speed on the was set really high. The engine was idling quite high. So I adjusted the fuel pump to bring the idle back down to whereabouts it should be. And the oil light was on. And I thought, that's not very good. So I adjusted the idle back down, and I've sort of been doing a few tests and checking a few things. And yesterday I removed the fuel lift pump and its plate from the side of the engine, and sure enough, the rear camshaft bearing isn't there.
So let me this. So I have a question.
Okay,
has the bearing been removed? When you say it's not there, has it been fitted without one by accident?
No. So this is it's not a common fault, but it is known that if 200 TDI, especially if it's run too hot, the rearmost camshaft bearing can either spin in its housing or it can walk out.
Okay.
And generally, you won't notice a difference in running because the camshaft's a big chunk of the thing and it's supported by three other bearings. So it will likely just carry on. You'll just have no oil pressure, which is what I believe's happened here. The strange thing is, obviously, I've had the engine on a stand upside down with the sump and the ladder frame off, and I couldn't see anything wrong. Granted, I wasn't looking closely for any problems with the bearings, but there was no chunks in the sump. There was no, like, the bearing sometimes stays on the camshaft and rattles around or gets mangled by the cam. There was none of that. So I need to basically pull the engine back out and strip it all down, which is a bit annoying to say the least.
When you say strip the engine down, do you need to pull the pistons and everything, or are you gonna?
So it all depends on whether I choose to completely rebearing the engine, because if it's been run for a long time with no oil or low oil pressure, the big end bearings on the connecting rods for the pistons will likely be worn. The main bearings where the crankshaft runs will likely be worn. It's kind of a may as well type situation because none of the bearings are particularly expensive. And when you're down that far, it's kind of, do you just go the whole hog and just rebuild the whole thing?
You're, because you can, I think you probably should.
Well, I can to a degree, but the camshaft bearings from factory would have been line bored, so they would have been fitted to the engine.
Yes.
All four bearings would have been fitted, and then a big, long bore, like a reamer, would have gone through them to make sure they're completely in true.
Oh, okay, yes.
That isn't necessarily, you don't necessarily have to do that now because Turner's Engineering, I've actually got the bearings in front of me, sell a slightly more modern type of bearing, which is easier to fit, and they generally don't need line boring. But it's difficult to say, really. I think if I'm going to do it, I might as well just do all of it now. I'm sort of so far into it that it's kind of irrelevant at this point. I might as well. But it's whether the engine's got to go to a specialist to have the cam bearings fitted or whether I can make up a tool and pull them into place myself. It's all a bit...
Okay. So where do you stand then buying a second-hand engine from a reputable-esque supplier?
Well, Steve, I'm glad you asked that question.
So, because obviously you buy something in good faith from a company.
Yeah.
It's difficult to prove that perhaps they knew about the problem, but they had the engine running themselves.
Well, this is the other thing, is when I got the engine, obviously it all turned up on a pallet. When I got the engine, it had an adapter for an oil pressure gauge on the filter housing. So whichever vehicle that came out of had an oil pressure gauge. So they would have seen what oil pressure it had. So there's absolutely no way they can tell me, oh, we didn't know. Like the idle was set high. Like even if the idle was set high enough to put the light off, which is exactly what's happened here, oil pressure would have been very low compared to what it should be.
Just because the light goes out doesn't mean the oil pressure is sufficient. That's what you're saying, isn't it? It's just, it just turns the light off.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't make the problem go away.
No. So as far as where you stand with used engines, so generally, I mean, I've looked through the fine print of this place, which I'm not going to name because I'm still giving them a chance to attempt to, you know, do something. But they have a 30-day warranty, right?
Okay.
So when the engine turns up, it was an old TDI, you know.
Let's be realistic here. But yeah, you didn't pay old TDI money though. You paid decent money for it.
I did pay decent money for it, but it did come with a gearbox and a transfer box. So I think I paid a fair price for it.
Okay.
It had a lot of oil leaks, as old engines do. So I put it on a stand. I took the rear flywheel housing off. I took the sump off. I took the ladder frame off. I invested time and a bit of money in resealing everything to make it as good as I possibly could before I fitted it. I've obviously had the timing cover off the front. I've had done the timing belt. I've done the water pump. I've done the crankshaft seal on the front because that was filling the timing case up with oil because someone had left the drain bung in. Basically, I'm quite a lot of time and money into this engine now. I've rebuilt the turbo. The turbo was pretty bad when I got it. There was a lot of play in the turbo shaft, so I've put a new turbo center assembly in it. That obviously wasn't cheap and it was quite time consuming. So yeah, they give you 30 days basically to flag any problems with the engine, and when the engine turns up and it needs this kind of attention, 30 days isn't that long when you're doing it
as you'd need to spend the next 30 days mucking around, wouldn't you, and ensuring it was in. And
I mean, unless you were fitting it, unless you were a garage and you were fitting it for a customer, you're not going to be working on it all day, every day, from the day you get the engine delivered.
No,
so what I'm saying is, I was well outside that 30-day window. So as far as I can tell, warranty-wise, nothing is covered. Whether that's, you know, morally the right thing to do or not is a whole other... The main thing for me is I'm not that. I would never expect any breakers or anywhere that sells used parts to sell something and the customer expect it to be brand new. What I wouldn't expect is for it to be quite so blatantly covered up that engine has a problem.
Yeah, that's the bit that sticks in my throat, really. If I would be royally hacked off because, yeah, you bought something in good faith. So the warranty, like you say, 30 days, fine. But the oil leaks, you can live with, or you do something about it. The turbo, to a certain degree, unless that, you know, they would know that that turbo had play in it.
Yeah, I mean...
you know, they would have inspected it as a breaker, wouldn't they? They would know that, you know.
You'd like to hope so, but you just don't know. It's not a company I've dealt with before, but the actuator on the turbo was damaged when it turned up as well. And I thought, oh, it's probably happened on the pallet. You know, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, and I should have flagged it then, but I didn't. And they're like, oh, well, we haven't seen any correspondence about problems with this engine, but you're never going to know there's a problem with the engine until it's in the vehicle running, are you? So
yes, yeah. That's... I mean, imagine though, if you were paying somebody, you know, the going rate labour-wise to fit that engine, and then you've got to pay them again to take the engine out. That is a costly business.
That would be a horrible situation for the garage as well, because even if the customer had supplied the engine from a breakers or whatever, unless they'd specified that they wanted the whole thing going through and rebuilding, it obviously then falls on the garage to put it right.
Yeah.
How do you charge the customer to do the engine conversion twice? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. It's a bit of a...
Yeah, but that is why that highlights another issue with garages. The ones I've spoken to, a lot, you know, across the trade, are loath to get involved with many things anymore.
Yeah, I can see why.
A lot of garages now and specialists are turning work away, and they're picking and choosing what they want to take on. It's the same with body shops. They don't like the look of something or a project that's unfinished. They won't take it on.
Really?
Because they know that it's going to end up them not having to, or not being able to charge the going rate to the customer, because it's going to cost so much more time than it's actually worth.
Right.
And that's why a lot of the people now are just rebuilding Land Rovers from scratch, charging 80 grand plus the VAT or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose, because so, at least.
There's a real cost of doing this engine conversion. If you were, you know, what's the lowest garage rate per hour that you know of?
God, I've no idea these days. It's got to be at least 50, 60 quid plus VAT.
Has to be 50, 60 pounds plus the VAT. Well, if you were to put that into what you've done with this engine so far, and yet you've still got to do it all over again.
Oh, yeah.
You'd be into thousands, wouldn't you?
Definitely.
And this is the thing, and you're not a business. You're just technically an enthusiast doing your own car at home. But
yeah, absolutely.
It's not good. Really not good.
It's, yeah, it's really... Do you know what, though? What I'm actually glad I know what the problem is now, because when it first happened, I was researching, I was looking up, and I knew for a few people that TDI 200s especially can suffer from oil pressure problems in a couple of areas. There's a big O-ring on the oil pickup pipe that sits in the sump. Apparently that can perish and fall out, and that can cause a problem. There's another O-ring on the skew gear, which drives your oil pump and it drives your vacuum pump. Okay. There's an O-ring in that, which can go brittle, and that can cause oil pressure problems. And the camshaft bearing falling out isn't massively common. It's known about, but it's not like every 200 TDI has this issue. So I was kind of hopeful that it wasn't that, obviously, because it's kind of worst case scenario, but at least I know it's the not knowing that was annoying me more than knowing it needs taking out again.
But the other thing is now, because you know that the engine's been run for a period of time, let's be honest, without the correct oil pressure, that may have, what could it have, glazed the bores? Could it have, has it got hardened?
So it almost certainly will have caused accelerated wear on all the bearings. So your main bearings where your crankshaft spins, your big end bearings where your pistons go up and down on the crankshaft. Not too fussed about the bores, because they're not really, it's not really as much of an issue with that. 200 TDIs are very, very tough. In fact, I was chatting to a couple of people, and they were saying that one of them had a Discovery with over 200,000 miles on it, and the oil light was just on at idle, and it carried on going, and it was still, the engine was still fine long after the vehicle had dissolved around it. I was like, okay, cool, but yeah, I'd like to have some oil pressure.
Yeah, definitely. So not much to ask in an engine, is it? Let's be honest.
No, not really. And you know, you can chance these things, and sometimes you might get away with it for years, but you just know that when it did decide to fail, you'd be in the least convenient position possible. Do you know what I mean? It'd be in the middle of nowhere somewhere, and it would just be a massive pain. But I'll do, obviously, the head gasket. That's the next thing, which I'm really, really hoping doesn't bite me, is that if I'm going to do that, I will replace the head gasket, and I'm really, really hoping that the head isn't cracked, because 200 TDI heads are so hard to find now, good ones. Okay. So yeah,
it's been a great, yeah.
Whose idea was it to put a TDI in this car again, Steve?
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own, and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information, or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
You will thank me one day, I promise. Like, yeah, they are so good. And I know you nearly went back to just putting the old... No, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought, you can't go backwards now. You're too far forward.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it, but you will thank me come the spring when you're zooming around in a TDI. It'll be the Land Rover you need.
I hope so. But anyway, let's get back to being a bit more positive. Would you like to hear a listener's question?
Absolutely, I would, because I missed last week's podcast.
I was over, yeah, messing about with Drew. I've actually got a listener's question about that as well, but we'll do this one first. Gary Pierce has been in touch. He says, "Hi, Martin and Steve. I've been listening to some older episodes about buying and modifications, and I thought about what about doing a modified Discovery 2 buying guide, because they're all over Marketplace and they're probably quite a few people's way into Land Rovers." You're probably right, I would say, Gary. He says, "My own Discovery 2 only had two issues when I bought it. One was the mess of wires for various accessories, and the other was the medium springs, so medium duty springs, which were sagging because it had a bull bar, a winch bumper on the front of the vehicle, which was causing the driver's side to lean." He said both issues were easily fixed. I wondered what else people should look for when buying modified Discovery 2s and other modified Land Rovers. Love the podcast and excited to attend some events this year, Gary. Well, we hope to see you there, Gary. Come and say hello. But as for your question, that is actually a very, very good question, and not one that I've really given too much thought about until now. But you raise an excellent point.
Yeah, it is. Discovery 2s are modified. There are more people probably ask me about them than any other Land Rover, because if that people are new to it, you either know about Land Rovers or you don't. If you're new to thinking about Land Rovers and it's like, you know, that's a second car, but they are a perfect entry point, as we've said. But as for modified, for me, I would always look at the quality of the modifications. And
definitely,
yeah, and I know it sounds really horrible, but almost you need to look at the person that's carried them out. So if somebody owns a car, you kind of get a picture as to, you know,
I think that is
what kind of condition it's in and if it's presented well. But there's modified and then there's modified, isn't there?
Definitely. Yeah, as you say, the quality of the parts used and the quality of the workmanship can vary massively with any modified vehicle. But Discovery 2s are obviously a bit of a favourite with off-roaders and things like that. So, and for a long time, they were right at the bottom of the budget, sort of getting into a solid axle Land Rover. So I think it's fair to say some of them will have been modified with possibly not the most care and attention and money spent on bits. So yeah. What I would say is, to be honest, with any vehicle that I look at with a view to buying it, is check out the tyres. Because if it's got, it's a pretty good gauge off the bat without asking too many questions of what sort of level the vehicle's been looked after to. If you've got mismatched tyres, if you've got really, really, really cheap, nasty, or if they're really old and they've got cracks and splits in them, things like that, you can pretty much guarantee the rest of the thing, the rest of the vehicle is going to be a pile.
But I always think if the tyres protrude illegally from outside of the car, the side of the car, you know, or the wheel arch, then again, I would walk away. So if somebody's modified the wheel arches to accommodate a slightly wider tyre, well, you say, you know, you can get those wider wheel arches, can't you?
Yeah.
Then fine. But if they're sticking out on their own too much illegally, then I wouldn't touch it.
Fair. Yeah. I mean, we could really, really go down a rabbit hole here because suspension is a massive thing. Like, people love lifting Discovery 2s. So, but you can only do that to a certain degree before everything gets, you know, throws a wobbly and gets very upset. So, like, the rear prop shaft on them uses a rubber donut at the differential end. And if you lift the thing too high with that, it shreds the rubber, basically, and causes vibrations. So the fix for that is to fit a 4-bolt flange on the rear diff and run a prop shaft with 2 proper universal joints rather than the rubber donut. And if you're lifting it even higher than, say, 2 inches, you need to have a wide-angle prop shaft. Same on the front. Corrected suspension geometry if you've lifted, you know, a certain amount of height, probably normally 1.5 inches is kind of the limit you can go to before you start running into problems. So if someone's put 2-inch lift springs and then 2-inch bodge blocks, I call them, the spacers under.
Yeah, so that's now 4 inches, isn't it?
And done nothing else.
Mm.
The brake lines are stretched.
Can you imagine how horrendous that would drive?
Exactly. I would probably avoid anything like that. Obviously, the other thing for Discovery 2s is people get them and then they get all enthusiastic and they start buying, you know, your big light bars and things like that. But they ignore the fact that the back half of the chassis is dust. So
yeah.
You really need to get underneath it and give it a good jab with a screwdriver and make sure that someone hasn't, you know, they say you can't polish a turd, but you can roll it in glitter. Well, that's what a lot of the Discovery 2s.
Well, that is very true. Very, very true. I, do you know what I'd take? If somebody's fitted spotlights or a light bar to the front, I would then go and have a look, not necessarily the brand of the light bar, but I'd have a look at the wiring.
Yes. Good point.
Yeah. So because that will highlight kind of how bad things could be.
Yeah.
If something's all neatly wired, it's all lovely cable tied and it all looks properly, it's all fused, everything's lovely, the switches are all look cool. Yeah, okay, someone's thought about it. I'm just quickly fitting something I've just got from eBay or something, you know?
Scotch locked it in or twisted and taped it together. Yeah. Just straight off the back of the main beam. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so I think, but I would also argue that, a lot of people look for a standard one now, don't they, to then go on and modify.
Yeah, true. I think that's becoming slightly less.
Yeah, but I'd almost go to say, leave the standard ones alone now.
I would. I mean, it's not our business to tell anyone what to do, but I would actually agree with you.
Yeah, leave them because there's going to be so few of them around.
It's it's funny. We sometimes you see a standard Discovery 1 or 2 come up for sale on Facebook, and people jump on there and say, "No, buy one that's already modified," because you know they're hard to find without the arches cut out, especially the Discovery ones, the rear quarter panels. They're good ones are people are cutting them off scrap cars and refitting them to ones that have had the arches cut out for bigger tires and things like that. I think preserving what's not been messed with already is quite important now.
I think so.
So if you're going to buy a modified one, by all means, go for it, because they are great fun and they're brilliant off-road. 100-inch wheelbase with like slightly increased tyre size and, you know, TD5 engine. They're flipping good off-road.
Oh, they're fantastic things. Comfortable. I saw a lovely one actually in Bourne, our local town, yesterday. Walked past of the 8 one, nonetheless.
All right.
Yeah, really nice thing to see. Really nice.
So, yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with buying a modified one. And it'll also save you quite a lot of money, because people, I think, generally accept that they won't get back the investment they've put into the car. So they'll generally, you know, as compared to buying a standard one, spending all the money yourself, you will save cash if you buy one already done. But it's important. The other thing I would say is look at what filters it's got on it. That's another really good thing. If you look at the state of like the diesel filter in the wheel arch, have a little peek behind the cover. If it's really got tons of surface rust on it and it's a really, really cheap brand you've never heard of, that probably isn't a great sign.
Mm.
When you drive it, make sure, you know, knocking noises, chattering, vibrations from the driveline, if it has got lifted suspension, all these things point to someone who's not done it properly.
Yeah, and yes. And if I think if the interior, you know, if it's just because something's been off-roaded doesn't mean the interior needs to look like,
yeah,
like filth and water ingressed, you know, somebody's been, you know, wading through a clay pit or something like that, and all of a sudden it's all coming out under the doors. It's all, yes, in the footwells, under the mats. Oh,
there's
a sludgy, damp smell.
Yeah, when you put your foot on it, all the like muddy water comes up round your boot and stuff like that.
Yeah, you get that kind of like football kit that's been left for a week in a bag smell. Oh, awful.
I'm 100% with you. I think that's entirely valid. I think, to be honest, you'll get the feeling. You'll get a good feeling about the right vehicle when you go and look at it, because the person will be enthusiastic. It will have been done properly. You'll actually recognise the brand of tyre that's on it, and hopefully they all match. Oh, the other good one is the spare tyre the same brand and pattern as the four that are on the wheels?
Ah, the valid. Do you know what? Yes, I 100% agree. I always have the same matching tyre as a spare, I do.
Because
the right size will help. But yeah.
I think
as a headlining being held up by staples.
The headlining is kind of a neither here nor there, because you're kind of looking at, that's kind of a problem with even if you're buying a standard one.
Oh, they are, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if the back half of the headlining is completely falling down and all the foam's gone everywhere and no one's bothered to clean it up or try and repair it in any kind of capacity, then that's obviously a runaway type job. Open the bonnet and see if it's been waded really, really deep, because there'll still normally be like a watermark on the inside of the engine bay and the inner wings and stuff.
Of course, yeah.
If the engine bay is absolutely coated in like clay and if you can see where the water's been lapping at the inside of the inner wings, you know, you've got to clean stuff after you use it off-road, especially to that extent. So I'd probably question that as well. Yeah, I think you can trust your instincts a lot on these, and you'll get the vibe, really, if someone's actually keen to look after it properly, or if they just want to abuse it every weekend and park it up dripping and soggy and muddy and not service it.
Yeah, there are a lot out there at the end of the day. You don't have to buy the first one you see.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, I think we probably should. I tell you what one thing to have a look at a modified one. If you check out our YouTube page on and look at our latest Newbury off-road course videos, because Eddie Priscott's there with the Terra Firma Discovery 2. That's nicely modified.
Yes, that's a really good example of one that's been done nicely.
Like, yes, all the right stuff in the right places.
I know it's possibly a slightly unfair advantage that it belongs to Terra Firma, so all their kit fits nicely with all their other kit. But, you know, mild suspension lift, mildly increased tyre size, got a locking rear diff. You know, everything's done properly. It hasn't got a 52-inch curved £20 light bar self-tapping through the bonnet. Do you know what I mean? So,
which those self-tappers we use in the thing of his light bar,
which is slowly filling up with water and getting green algae in it, like you see. Do you know what I mean? It's the quality kit.
But it highlights, you know, you don't have to do it all at once, but that highlights what's possible and probably, you know, the pinnacle of what it should be. And we've mentioned before Richard Canterbury's discovery too. If you're modifying for expedition as opposed to off-roading, because we've spoken about off-roading quite a lot here, haven't we? But you might be wanting just a family car to do European road trips.
Yes.
Then here's one highlights absolutely what's possible.
Yeah, 100%.
Anyone that goes and sees that car up front, anyone that goes and has a look at it in the flesh, as it were, then they would absolutely want to own it.
Yeah, definitely. That really is like the top of the tree, really. Another fella, Simon Cox, got a lovely black Discovery too. I think he's had from New. He's decked that out really nicely for overlanding and camping. And you can just tell he's invested in the vehicle and everything's done properly. I need to catch up with him, actually. But
those are the sort of Land Rover Discoveries that don't necessarily come up for sale.
No.
So you buy a solid one to start with. Start with a solid foundation and just modify for what you need, not what you think you need.
Definitely. Definitely. I think a lot of people forget how capable these cars are as standard. And they, you know, they chuck the, you know, the catalogue at it without really figuring out where the weak points are. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're sort of get so carried away with bolting stuff to it that they don't really refine it through their own experiences. They refine it because they're fitting what they think they need.
Absolutely. Yeah. I get you.
But yeah, it's part of the fun. And a well-looked-after Discovery of any generation, really, that's been properly rust-proofed will last you years and years and years. They've lasted this long. They will keep going.
Yeah. Talk about Discoveries. I noticed that Discovery 4 are now featuring on the JLR Classic Parts.
Indeed. Apparently, they are now a proper classic.
Yeah. Because I remember when the Discovery 3 went on there and I couldn't believe it. I thought, well, of course, you know, Discovery 4 has been out since, 2009, 10. So that's a, you know, sort of 16-year-old car now, the earliest Discovery 4.
Oh, no. Already. Scary.
Yeah.
Scary. But yeah, it's cool though. It means that, you know, if you want to get genuine parts, you can go to the Classic Parts website. And I'll tell you what, I'm a bit cheeky really, because I value the parts diagrams and stuff like that that JLR use on that website, because you can really pinpoint exactly what you need. And don't get me wrong, sometimes they don't have absolutely everything. Quite a lot of the bits I've looked for in the past have been no longer available or back order or whatever, but
yeah, of course.
Once you've got that part number and you've drilled down, you know, you can go off and find it elsewhere if you need to, which is handy. But yeah, really interesting. Discovery 4,
I'm sure JLR won't mind people going onto their website to look at part numbers to then go off and go shopping elsewhere, because it's a hit to their website, isn't it? And exposes the fact that you might be intrigued to look at other Land Rovers for sale or whatever else, or what the dealerships have to offer.
Definitely. It's a hit. Well, like you say, it's a hit to their website. And if they don't have it, then somewhere else might. So it is what it is. But right, but let's stick with Discovery, shall we? This is like turning into a bit of a Discovery special, this podcast. But Andrew Doughty, he emails in and says, hi, Martin. I'm glad you're embracing the Discovery 5. Yes, I did. I did rather fall in love with it by the time
it went back.
Yeah, it went back last Monday.
Oh, did it? Okay.
And thankfully, no one from JLR's emailed me complaining about the wheels yet. But I did pre-warn them. So anyway, he says, I'm glad you're embracing the D5. I've owned one since October 24. It's a commercial that's been converted to have back seats in it. And I use it every day. It's done 147,000 miles and it's only 5 years old. That's a good run. He says, it's a great car with lots of space and comfort. I change the oil every 6,000 miles and I've had all the oils done and filters and the timing belts. I've also got a 1953 Series 1 86 inch and I'm looking for an early 90s to renovate. Keep up the good work and the podcasts. They're brilliant. Kind regards, Andrew Doughty. Well, thank you very much for the kind words, Andrew. That's really cool of you. Glad you're having a good experience with your Discovery as well. They are fantastic. a proper Land Rover man as well, with a Series 1 in his collection. So fair play to you.
And it's about, if he buys his third one, he's got the perfect, I think, probably the perfect mix there.
I think so, yeah. A good trio to have, actually. Yeah, but it just shows that they'll, you know, they will do it. They're handy things. My friend's boss's one, in fact, has literally just done its engine, but it's on way over 200,000 miles. So, you know, that's not bad innings for a car.
Not really. Yeah. 200,000 miles is a decent amount.
Yeah. Yeah. And looking after them is key. But yeah, we won't dabble on engines on this podcast, because we do go on about them quite a bit, especially the loyal 2-litre Ingenium. But we have another question from John Ireland. Are you ready?
I am indeed.
He says, "Hi, Martin and Steve. I'm another of your dedicated listeners, and I enjoy the inane banter as much as the Land Rover content." Well, you're going to get equal parts of each. He says, "I'm a lifetime lover of Land Rovers, and I've owned loads of different models with assorted engines over the years. After a few years without owning a Land Rover, last year I bought one of my favourites, a Series 3 long wheelbase station wagon with a 2.25 petrol engine, which I am loving. Following your excellent advice on the number of Land Rovers one should have, I am drawn to add a coil sprung model, and like you, Martin, I do like a 110. You seem to rarely mention the Puma engines, so the TDCI. I guess you don't rate them, but there are a few for sale at the moment, and I wonder which I should look out for, or if I should stick to a TD5 like Steve. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to meeting you at Fest in the summer and getting a selfie on the salmon sofa. Keep on Land Rovering, Johnny from Sussex."
Yeah, we don't talk about Pumas very much, but some people really, really detest that engine, but I quite like it. I mean, it's a completely different driving experience to a TD5.
Yes, yeah. So it was, yeah, late 2006, 2007, the 2.4 came out. Ford engine, Transit derived. Everyone called it the Transit engine. And what a lot of people don't realise is that had that revision not been made, had that engine and gearbox combination not come about and the dashboard got revised, things like that, that would have been at the end of Defender then.
Mm, yeah.
So they did effectively extend its lifespan by almost another 10 years by making those changes and going with the Ford bits. So kind of whether you like it or you don't like it, that has to be acknowledged. Personally, I don't have tons of experience with them. I worked on them a fair bit. They didn't seem unreliable. I remember the EGR problems occasionally, and yeah, there's a few recalls on them. But other than that, like, I didn't really have any negative experiences with them. The 2.2 I always felt was a bit quieter than the 2.4, probably because it's got that massive diesel particulate filter right in the engine bay. But yeah, I don't really have anything bad to say about Pumas, but I don't really get excited about them either.
No, I know exactly what you mean. They don't sound, I don't enjoy the sound they make compared to a TD5.
Yeah.
But for drivability, it's a completely different league, really.
Well, the 6-speed box was kind of, I wanted to like it, but it was kind of a bit notchy and a bit, it doesn't actually give you any higher a gear ratio than the outgoing TD5 did. Obviously, it had the higher ratio transfer box, it had the 1.2 ratio transfer box.
Yeah,
but
of course.
Yeah, I don't know. They're okay.
I haven't driven one for a while, you know.
Maybe we need to get behind the wheel of one again and see what it's about.
Yeah, let's make that a thing. So we can do that very, very quickly. We'll get behind the wheel of one. Probably do a bit of YouTube or something just to refresh ourselves.
Yeah,
we drive the stuff we get used to. Then now and again, you'll get the Discovery 5, like I had for a couple of days, and you know, kind of you get. You get that stuff, but we're not driving enough Land Rovers, are we?
No, it is more difficult to get that variety. But I'm sure, yeah, I think it's about time we revisited a few different ones that we haven't sort of had much to do with for a while. Because it is important that In fact, I'm going to read that email out in a minute because that's a cracking email. It is important that we encompass everything in the range, even
yeah, just
like you say, down to screwing it down as far as defender. But I'll read this email out. I was going to save this until a future podcast, but actually it's that relevant that I think I'll read it to you now. Daniel Dolan's got in touch and he says, I listened to your recent interview with Drew Wright with a mix of respect for his engineering and frustration at his rhetoric. While his series truck, which is Volvo axled and highly modified for winter challenges, is a masterpiece, his claim that the L663 shouldn't carry the Defender name is the kind of gatekeeping we can't really afford. He says, he goes on about Discovery One being launched and how people called it the poor man's Range Rover, yet now they're revered and highly regarded models, which is absolutely right. But basically, the gist of it is we need to stop slating the newer stuff and we need to really get on board with it, which, to be fair, I think both of us are quite pragmatic about. I think some people are really stuck in their ways and they absolutely detest anything new and anything even with coil springs is the work of the devil. But he goes on to say, I run a club called Land Rover Adventures. We're a group of friends who take primarily newer generation vehicles on extreme road trips. We've taken an Evoque and a Freelander 1 to Chernobyl in midwinter. We took that same Evoque to Tromso in the Arctic Circle alongside Freelander 2s. We've taken a Velar and a new Defender to Nordkap in minus 28 degrees C.
Wow.
We regularly trek across the Pyrenees and head to the Alps or Gibraltar on a whim. Yet, despite these thousands of miles in extreme conditions, I frequently find myself being lectured by people who think a Land Rover Adventure is a half-day trip to the next county. I'm told the L663, Evoque or Velar are not worthy of the name by people whose own vehicles rarely leave their own postcodes. Wow. Shocked being fired, but I can totally understand your frustration.
Very controversial.
He says, the L663's just earned its stripes in the Dakar Rally, which isn't a bespoke challenge truck, and it's an incredibly capable machine. We want a future. If we want a future, we must embrace the technology that keeps the brand alive, including hybrids. We must also denounce the rolling coal and, if in doubt, flat out brigade. Yeah, I'm kind of inclined to agree about that, to be fair. And we need to continue treading lightly and using such methods as the old adage of slow as possible, fast as necessary. If we continue to prioritize nostalgia over inclusion and genuine capability, we won't have a community left to defend. It's time to stop being curators of a dying past and start being advocates for a sustainable, adventurous future. I'd like to add that I really love the podcast, and as a general rule, I feel it does strike the right balance between old and new. I subscribe to the magazine, support as many shows as I can, especially the LRM ones like Live, and I look forward to LRM Fest. Yours sincerely, Dan Dolan. Well, first of all, Dan, thank you ever so much for such a well-written and interesting email. You sound like you get up to some really cool stuff, and I'm definitely going to drop you a line and see if we can do something with you in the mag, because that's really, really cool.
Those trips sound amazing. I've been looking at Nordkap myself, to be fair. Minus 28 is not that appealing, though, is it?
Oh, you'd be right. Little diesel heater. But no, I mean, all the latest crop of Land Rovers are tested, you know, to extreme conditions, both high, you know, temperatures and low temperatures. Mm-hmm. And they are, you know, regardless of what they get used for by people who buy them new, they are genuinely developed to put up with the very worst conditions imaginable, and you know, fair play to JLR for continuing to do it.
Yeah, one of those points about the L663 not taking on the Defender name, but Land Rover could name it what they like. You know, it had the old one had to stop. It did, and a new one is a great car. It's not Trevor One's chase. If you're in the camp of an old Land Rover, stay there. That's fine. But don't not include the new ones or the people who choose to drive.
I think being against the new models is futile for a start, because, you know, thousands of people own them and thousands of people love them regardless of their quirks, shall we say. But to say that I don't know if I agree with the clinging on to nostalgia bit, because that's such an important part of the reason so many people are into Land Rovers is because they had an experience with one when they were younger, or they a family member owned one when they were little, or they always wanted one when they were a kid, and now they've got that model that they've, you know, they always wanted a Defender, and now they've bought like a TDI or a TD5 or whatever. I don't think that should be ignored either, but I do agree that some people are too narrow-minded when it comes to the new stuff.
No, 100%. Yeah. I mean, they say evolution, not revolution. You have to evolve. Mm. You just switch one off and turn one on. It's constantly evolving. You know, imagine the future of Land Rover as we sit here now. You know, they'll be developing stuff that we won't see for years.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
You know, and that's exciting, surely.
Mm. I think Daniel's, his sort of willingness and passion for going and using these, like you say, the Evoques, the Freelanders, L663s, whatever, Velars, in extremes and in conditions that otherwise most people wouldn't think about is absolutely admirable. And yeah, fair play to you. And it shows that they'll do it, which is the most important thing. So It's like for a long time, people slated the new Defender when it came out, regardless of what they thought it looked like, because I don't know, they just felt like it was a bit wet, but it isn't, is it? It's ridiculously capable. And as soon as you drive one, you realise that, yeah, it's all your sort of fears about how capable it is go out the window. And, you know, with things like Dakar, hopefully JLR will continue to prove that.
Yeah, I think they'll put, like, quite rightly, you said that they'll probably end up with some more competition.
Yeah, I think
in the coming years. That'll make it even more interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be really interesting to see, what happens in the future with Dakar and with JLR's, you know, new range when they release a new vehicle. Definitely. Exciting times ahead.
Well, it's great that events like that can happen, you know.
Yeah. They really do elevate stuff. It's cool. Right. Feature of the week. Talking of blending old with new, Steve, you'll like this one.
Have you segued nicely into something here?
Yeah, kind of. So,
finding the right parts for your Land Rover or Range Rover shouldn't be an off-road challenge. At bmh4x4.com, we've built a smarter way to get you back on track. Our new website is now live, the simple, fast, and reliable way to find the parts and accessories you need. Supplying quality parts for Defender 1983 to 2016, Discovery 1, 2, 3, and 4, Range Rover Sport 2005 to 2013, with Range Rover P30A and L322 coming soon. All parts are backed by expert knowledge, quick delivery, and a 2-year quality guarantee. Visit bmh4x4.com, built by enthusiasts for enthusiasts.
Obviously, when the Defenders, you know, the original Defender came to an end, JLR hosted several celebratory events for, to mark its ending of production. And one of those was to draw a massive outline of a Defender on Red Wharf Bay. And it used a team of 6 Land Rovers to do this, all with Harrows behind them on Red Wharf Bay when the tide was out. And one of those Land Rovers is a 90, which is in the classic section of this month's Land Rover Monthly. Some cracking pictures of it actually performing the stunt, if you like, of making this huge outline on the sand. And a bit about who owns it now. Simon O'Leary from Rover Social now has it in his care. And yeah, it's a really just a lovely, honest little 90.
Ah, no, I've seen his 90. That is a lovely, lovely example.
Yeah, a little truck cab with a till on the back. Absolutely, yes. A Houston thing. So be sure to grab the full story of that in the latest issue, which is on sale right now. Would you like a product of the week before we sign off and go and do some work?
Well, absolutely. I've not heard of products of the week for a little while, so far away.
Our friends at Off Grid Camp are now doing T-shirts.
Okay.
Not just any old T-shirts, a heavyweight T-shirt. So for £32, made from 100% heavyweight cotton, These long-sleeved, oversized t-shirts are perfect for wearing around the campsite, layering up on a chilly morning, or wearing loose as the day warms up. They have a small off-grid camp logo on the front and a larger graphic from Rowan Leary at Sorbo Design on the back. And it's very cool. It's a Defender with a roof tent or a pop top and an awning and Camp Somewhere Wilder on the back. Really, really cool. £32. And you can get them from offgridcamp.co.uk. So be sure to check that out.
That's actually not a bad shout, actually. So you can join Off-Grid Camp, can't you, and get access to all these locations to camp?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, campsites that you can't otherwise get. It's all privately owned land by farmers and, you know, landowners across the country, across the UK, in fact. And yeah, really sort of exclusive camping areas by joining Off-Grid Camp. So head over to their website, offgridcamp.co.uk. Have a look at what they do, and you'll probably see them at our events this year as well, all being well. So catch up with them there. Lovely people. And it's a whole other element to camping, really.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, more wild sort of camping. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. Well,
I've got myself.
Yes, definitely. I need to renew my membership, actually. And actually, I need to refit my roof tent. But that's a job for another day. But I think
we'll see the eye problems first.
Yeah, exactly. I need to fix the vehicle that the tent's going to go on before I get too excited. But yes, all good fun. Keeps us busy, doesn't it?
It does. But so let's call it. Yeah, because we're doing this over Teams today. So hopefully...
Yeah, we are. Hopefully Tom Bayford drops me a message and tells me how good the audio is, despite us not using a professional microphone or anything. So hopefully it comes out okay. Yeah. Anyway... all good fun. But no, thank you ever so much for listening. Follow us on Instagram. I'm Land Rover Martin. Steve is Steve Miller Automotive. Follow Land Rover Monthly. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, because all four installations of the off-road course build for the Newbury Big Land Rover Fest are now live. So you can laugh at Steve and I bouncing around in my Series 3 and him getting stuck, me getting stuck, lots of mud flying, lots of excavator action. Yeah, it's all good fun. And
that's fantastic stuff.
Go out and buy the magazine, because it's a cracking issue and I'm really proud of it. So yeah, as always, if you want to leave us a little rating or a review on your preferred streaming platform, we would really appreciate it. And send your questions or feedback to editorial@lrm.co.uk. Thanks very much, and we will see you next week.
Bye for now.